Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. The Louisiana State Penitentiary, Angola Prison, is an old plantation on the Mississippi River. It was named long ago for the birthplace of the slaves who worked there. Musicologist Daniel Atkinson went inside the Angola prison walls in the early 2000s for his doctoral dissertation research. He returned with music, stories, and a lot of passion. Later in the show, we'll check in on our weekly Tell KCUR series, and we'll also hear about what looks like an abandoned castle on 18th and Vine. Turns out that this structure is a former jail or workhouse. More about that later. For now, it's an honor to welcome Daniel Atkinson to Central Standard. He's currently living in Lawrence, where he works as Assistant Director of the African Studies Center at KU. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Thank you for having me. It's beautiful to be here.
It's beautiful to have you. Well, when did you become interested in the music of Angola Prison?
I heard a documentary by a man named David Isay, who did a documentary called Tossing Away the Keys.
And he's the StoryCorps guy.
He's the StoryCorps guy. And it was in 1990, and it was narrated by the now celebrated editor of the Angolite, who is now free, Wilbert Rideau. And it featured some absolutely fantastic a cappella gospel by a group called the Angola Gospel Superiors and the Gospel Melodies. And it was just absolutely beautiful. And having grown up in the church and hearing that old school four-part harmony, it just always stuck with me. And then I came across the Lomax recordings on Rounder Records at about 94 or so.
Tell us what those are in case some of our listeners don't know.
Okay, so John and Alan Lomax, the founders of the Library of Congress, more or less, went all throughout the South, particularly in large prison camps at Huntsville in Texas, Parchman in Mississippi, and Angola in Louisiana, where they discovered Huey Leadbetter, also known as Leadbelly, and made recordings of inmates, particularly doing ring shouts, work songs, field hollers, and catching the odd oral history here and there.
Wow. So you've heard these sort of this documentary and then these much earlier recordings. What inspired you to attempt to go to Angola yourself? Can you remember the moment when curiosity and interest became more action-oriented, took on more momentum?
Okay, well, my maternal grandparents are from northern Louisiana, and if not for World War II, my family would have been stuck in that cycle of poverty. My grandfather got out, became a Tuskegee Airman, and basically put his sisters through college and basically gave us the drive to go and be more than what society expects for us in one way or another. So I have a PhD. My mother has a PhD. My older brother is now finishing his. My younger brother's also served and is now working on a degree. And I knew that Angola was there because it always hangs over everyone's head, knowing that it's an old slave plantation. And it just...
Yeah, the slave plantation transformed into prison is... it's like it's a metaphor waiting to happen.
Yes. And knowing that how much I love the older music, I'm one of very few in my age group who likes that older music. I have a huge collection of 78s and played jazz for a number of years and love the older sounds, and wanting to know if it was still there because I had not heard any newer recordings since Harry Oster had been there in the 1950s. So I wanted to go back and see what was going on. And originally I wanted to take a look at and see how hip-hop had changed the ethos there because half of the inmates were 33 or younger, and I was 33 at the time. But that wasn't necessarily the case. But I did, just by happenstance, record some beautiful a cappella gospel, and that's what fueled the impetus for my second trip as well.
Well, yeah, tell us about your first trip there. What were you mentioned sort of what you were expecting. What did you actually encounter, both administratively trying to make this a reality and musically?
Well, like I said before, I was interested in recording hip-hop within the context of the culture there at the prison, as well as the gospel, which I was sure still existed. But I was told flat out that that didn't exist, the hip-hop, which was really interesting to me. And it showed that there was a... there may have been a strong disconnect between the cultural reality of the younger inmates who were coming in versus what they wanted and expected to hear. So that also let me know that they did not know that I was Afro-American, particularly when they...
Did you originally speak with them by phone or email or something?
Email, letters, telephone, and they wanted... what they would have preferred for me to do was to record inmate gospel ensembles in their preparation for a large revival-style gathering in the Rodeo Arena on August 6th, 2005. And so I wanted to basically make as little footprint as possible, make as little trouble as possible for myself and them, knowing what the situation was. And I just wanted to get in there and just see what it was like. I mean, this plantation is absolutely massive, 18,000 acres. It's about the size of Manhattan. And there have been black men working the land there since 1820. And I just wanted to get in just to see it, because I wanted to see it for myself. And I thought that maybe it would serve as a palimpsest, meaning it would be sort of a, I could look through the foundation basically of an older structure and then see back in time as to how people lived and thought and breathed, particularly my ancestors.
You mentioned that black men had been working this land since, was it the 1850s?
1820.
And what is the racial distribution of the inmates today?
I have purposefully remained ignorant of the stats since I finished the dissertation for a variety of reasons. But at the time of my research, it was about 85% black males. When I made my first trip, there were 5,163 inmates. And the vast majority, about 80%, will never leave because they have a life sentence.
I want to play a little bit of what you recorded there. We're going to, in a little bit, listen to a song called Thank You for One More Day. What do you want our listeners to know, either about the recording or the men they'll hear singing?
Okay, so the leader you're going to hear is a man by the name of Big John Taylor, a very special man there in the penitentiary, and an example of what some would call Jim Crow justice. And he has been at Angola since 1970. And it was 1986 when he was finally made aware. They finally told him what he had been convicted of, because when he was brought to the prison, a white man had been killed with a .38, and they needed someone to sort of squash this problem and just to go away for it, because they were unable or unwilling to really investigate the crime. I don't really know. He was convicted on circumstantial evidence. He was already known as a fairly unsavory character and had a .25 semi-auto in his pocket. So that was enough to convict him. It was circumstantial evidence. But he also suffers from some issues with his mental capacity at times. And so he held on to the old adage of, I will not give them any information to incriminate me because they're going to do what they're going to do anyway, and I'm not going to contribute to my own demise. So he said nothing and was really not terribly aware of what was happening in the legal system around him. So in 1986, he was given a new trial after 16 years of being incarcerated. And according to him, in his own oral history, his appointed lawyer, the district attorney, and the judge, they gave him a cup of coffee. He sat down in a chair outside the judge's office, went into the judge's office. They came out 5 minutes later and said, you've been found guilty, and they sent him back to Angola. And everyone in the prison, as far as I saw my interactions with him, they treat him as though he should not be there. And so they give him all kinds of respect and admiration. And he's an older man and an absolute master of the a cappella gospel tradition. He grew up in northern Louisiana near Shreveport and went to Chicago, and at about age 13 became a leader in a gospel group. And for those of you who do not know, or maybe do know, Chicago was the hotbed. That's where Sam Cooke came from, R.H. Harris. That's where Georgia Tom became Thomas A. Dorsey, Precious Lord, and Standing by the Bedside of a Neighbor. All those beautiful, beautiful hymns that we all still know to this day. He was there when all that stuff was happening and going down. So the inmates, the younger inmates and older inmates alike, they all treat him with a great deal of respect. And he's a fantastic singer. And he had a really fantastic group called the Gospel Melodies, who when he got on the radar for Warden Kane, said, oh, wow, you're really amazing. We should send you out to the other parts of the state, and you can sing as representatives of the prison and possibly for reform. So he was fine with that. But the problem was, not all the men in the group were trustees. That's a specific status that you can reach after a certain amount of years of basically showing that you're benign. And it's the way you get and maintain your status is very political. And not all the men were trustees, and so he wasn't interested in traveling without his core group. The warden decided to pick and choose inmates that he liked to put them in the group, and Mr. Taylor did not like that. And the younger inmates convinced him, let's just go out and try it. Please, just try it. So he went out and did two gigs with them and didn't like it and quit. And because of the political climate that created, he refused to sing.
Aww.
And so when I came back for the second visit, there were some older inmates who understood what I was trying to do and did everything possible to get other inmates who also sang in the quartet tradition to come sing for me, who were off the prison's radar. And
as far as their musical interest.
Their musical interest, their abilities, and...
Because they weren't part of the official group that went out.
Mm-hmm. There were a few that do that, and there are a few that have groups inside, but they're just unknown because they have their own culture. And so they went and grabbed him and then asked him to sing for me, and he told me his story. And he sang for me on this day, and it was the first time he'd sang in, I think it was 6 years.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're going to hear Thank You for One More Day.
Yes, well, heaven, yeah. And when old trouble gets in your way, and when you have faith. And been all disappointed unto care.
Daniel Atkinson, that is Thank You for One More Day. And what year is that recorded again?
That was recorded in 2007 in early August. It was like August 6th, I believe. And it's a tune, that's a hymn written by Hattie Foster. In the early 1950s, it was made famous by the Dixie Hummingbirds around 1955, a fantastic Tidewater gospel group led by Ira Tucker. Most people know them from them singing back up with Paul Simon on Loves Me Like a Rock.
One thing that really strikes me listening to this, although a lot of things really strike me listening to this, is that it sounds like a sound capsule from another era in some ways, like that this was 2007, that this is contemporary music.
The a cappella gospel tradition was the sound from the 1830s, back in the minstrel days, all the way through, the death of Sam Cooke in the late 1960s, and then the mass choirs by people like James Cleveland and Shirley Caesar, with these fantastic altos and sopranos, female altos and sopranos, that became the norm. And the quartet tradition still had a life in secular world, like with Four Tops and all the way up through Take Six and Boys to Men and folks like that. But it's not really as popular as it used to be, particularly after the advent of hip hop. But in that environment in the prison, especially where the old adage that nothing makes Southern whites happier than to have black people singing about Jesus because it means they're under control in one way or another.
That's an old adage. I've never heard it until you just said it. Can you tell us more about that adage?
It just means that they're under control and they're benign in one way or another. And that's the way things that were handled on the plantation is the way things were handled still in many ways in the South. And it's a great way for subversive culture and forms of communication, coded speak, to take place, where it sounds really beautiful. Like when he sings, when your burden is heavy. And he talks about all these things about how when cares made your hair turn gray, when you're all disappointed and things of that nature, Jesus knows just how much we can bear. And I'm so glad I know the work of prayer. So when we kneel down and pray, I thank you for one more day. And then he goes into sort of a revelation thing where the world turns upside down. But because it's so beautiful, it sort of soothes the people in control to thinking, oh, this is a beautiful thing. And I pray to the same God. But at the same time, that being on the odd man out in that binary, the good, bad, up, down, black, white binary, they can, if really God does exist, they can speak directly to him and say, look, God, are you paying attention to what's happening? We're praying to you too. Why is this happening? So when I get to the other side, will I still have to wait in line? Will I still have to be second? Will I still have to suffer? Will I still have to pick cotton?
Yeah. Okay. That does bring me to something kind of interesting. You collaborate with a jazz saxophonist named Howard Wiley, and he has a great quote, something he told the Jazz Times. He said, "There are cats out there picking cotton. I'm from California. I was born in Berkeley. Until my visit to Angola, I'd never seen cotton unless it was on some fruit of the looms."
So that's like what I said earlier about the palimpsest. This is the introduction of Africans to the United States up until the 20th century when people were coming more willing, or the late 19th century. And for me, it was a way to, it was a window into the past just to get an idea, because very often, particularly with my ancestors, my grandparents, they would not talk about the sort of things that they saw. I mean, my grandparents saw lynchings, they saw all kinds of horrible things. And to protect us from that, they would just say nothing. Which is good and bad things. Jewish people who lived through the Holocaust do that have the same issues with the youngsters. Latino immigrants who suffered horribly. Chinese people as well. They just don't talk about those things. The people who built the railroads. So I wanted to know, particularly because after the Civil Rights Act, we have, as black people, have lost a lot of that identity, that sovereignty that we held when we were supposedly inferior. And that sovereignty created a lot of beauty. That's where all our jazz and blues and gospel, the fantastic literature, we did our best work under those circumstances. And when we integrated, the dominant culture was able to pick and choose what they like and leave the rest. And many of us who have done that have done the same. And this was a great way for me to really encapsulate the entirety of black humanity, or at least their version of it, the men in that particular penitentiary, because they relate to the world in a very old way, that where the oppression is real and out and just not encoded, it's not hidden. And they have to address it in ways to where they can bring their humanity into the world without destroying themselves.
And a lot of those men have been in there since before integration.
At the time, yes. There aren't very many of them still living who were there, who've been there for that long. But I did meet several men who had been there since the 50s. And that was when the prison was an absolute bloody mess, particularly under the leadership of Governor Huey Long. But I wanted other black people and everyone in the country, for that matter, to really see how our history is still living. And you can't really deny this sort of thing, because a lot of people like to look back in the day as sort of a nostalgic thing. And they need to see all of it in its entirety, so we don't repeat it and we don't negate the experience of the people who are still living and still know that, because it's living memory. So I wanted to document that before it disappears, because when they go, it goes.
Well, and you didn't just record music in the prisons. You recorded prisoner testimonials. We're going to hear one shortly from Jackie Ingott. Tell us a little bit about his story, just what we need to know to understand his testimonial.
Okay, so Jackie is from New Jersey, a fantastic guitar player, a fantastic athlete, MVP volleyball, basketball, and softball. He's a great athlete and just a really brilliant musician. And he's one of the guys who is, how they say in there, got down bad. He did something wrong, but he is equated, he's a nonviolent criminal, but because he's a criminal, it's all the same. And so he just got sort of swept up. You'll hear him say it himself, but the guy was an absolutely brilliant musician. May he rest in peace. He was the guitarist for the Pure Heart Messengers, one of the groups I recorded.
Let's hear Jackie Ingott.
I know you haven't asked, but I'm going to tell you anyway. My charge is very serious, car theft. But anyway, yes, I'm serving a time for car theft. So if his kids listening, I would encourage them to stay in school and avoid criminal activity of any kind that would lead them to an institution like this, because laws in society is designed to destroy people that engage in criminal activity such as myself. It doesn't matter if you're a murderer, or like myself, a car theft, a rapist, or whatever. The way that they have the laws written, you could be lost in the system. Just like I am, lost in the system. I'm not a hardened criminal, but I'm a criminal because I stole something. And you can be lost in the system.
That was Jackie Ingott, as recorded by Daniel Atkinson, who's here with us today from KU's African Studies Center. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to Central Standard. And Daniel Atkinson, the thing that about the beginning of that clip we heard is that Jackie Ingott says, I know you didn't ask me, but I'm going to tell you anyway, which gets a little bit at your research methods. Can you talk about how you approached what people did, whether they're guilty, and how you interacted with them?
Well, they weren't allowed to discuss elements of their cases. And all of my interactions with inmates were strictly monitored by classification officers for real and present reasons. So I was able to ask their name, their number, how long they were incarcerated for, and some basic things about their musical philosophy or what they do with music. And but then I knew that that could open up a wellspring of information, because everything is relative, particularly with the way that Afro-Americans, in the traditional sense, everything is relative, and your entire experience comes out in your music and your art and your writing and everything, which is what makes things the way that they are, which is sort of, that's how you, when I talk about something being soulful, that's what I mean. You put everything into it. You know who you are in the context of the moment. And so I knew that soulful people could find creative ways to get their point across, because they always have and always will.
Well, let's hear one more testimonial before we get back to the music, because I want to get back to soulfulness pretty quickly. But we're going to hear another one from Jimmy Robinson, and he talks a little bit more about his beliefs about who has power and what they should do with it. Do you want to set this up a little bit?
Sure. Jimmy Robinson is now an inmate minister, and he has a specific quality to his voice, to where one day in the shower, he yelled across to another inmate, and one of the older singers heard him and then pulled him aside and said, "You are a natural second tenor. You need to come sing." And he had never sang before in his life. And then he's like, "Okay, fine, fine." So then he went and hung out with these older musicians and found that, you know, there was something that he could do. And it was easy, and it was fun, and it was fulfilling, and it was all the things that he never thought he could be or have on the outside. So he's a natural second tenor, and then also a very eloquent speaker.
Yeah, we'll hear that in a second. This is Jimmy Robinson.
To the people that are in position to make decisions, and especially decisions that govern other people's lives, I think it would be wise to judge each person individually. And the reason why I'm saying that is because if you judge all prisoners for the sake of all prisoners, well, then you will lose some very good people that only made one terrible mistake in their lives. And if it's like that, they'll spend the rest of their lives paying for one terrible mistake. So I would encourage them to judge, you know, from an individual perspective instead of overall.
Daniel, that is really incredible, just the measured way in which he's able to speak in sort of abstract terms without, it sounds like, rancor, anger.
Well, in order to gain trustee status, you have to become a politician. You know, you become a businessman of politics. And I want to say something before I get into trouble, because this always happens. I am not advocating for I'm not saying we should close all prisons and then that they don't have a place. I understand that prisons have a place in every society. There, you cannot have order without them. And I did meet several inmates who made me more or less nervous, and I could tell what they were capable of. But with that said, treating all inmates the same, be they the 25% who are in the penitentiary for drug offenses, or people who have some sort of a mental capacity issue to where it's only a matter of time before you break a rule, people who have treatable issues associated with their incarceration, those people can be dealt with in ways that are both inexpensive and humane, where in Louisiana, everyone is treated the same, and they're incarcerated, particularly at Angola, to the tune of $17,000 a year. That's more expensive than sending them to university, or pennies on the dollar to educate them as children, to basically give them the tools to where they can avoid that and find value in the things that they do that don't bring them to places where they're forced to pick cotton in under the guise of rehabilitation, which is not the case.
Daniel, I have spoken with a lot of academics over the years, and you come to this conversation with a different kind of, I don't know, there's a different kind of quality in the way you speak. There's a level of personal engagement, political engagement, and all the while you are a musicologist. Can you talk about your unique relationship with your subject matter? It seems unique to me anyhow.
Well, I'm an ethnomusicologist, which is different. They differentiate. One is dead Frenchmen and dead Germans, more or less, and the other one is everyone else, including dead Frenchmen and dead Germans when they are borrowing from people who are not dead Frenchmen and dead Germans. But well, I grew up in an environment where many of the guys I grew up with ended up going through the penal system or doing things that they thought were necessary because they felt as though they didn't fit in to society in one way or another. And that those men in that penitentiary could just as easily be me, or even far worse in my native California, where you're locked in a cage for 23 hours a day with no human contact. There's got to be a better way to do this, and I'm just trying to open a dialogue on this because it's wasted potential.
Well, we're going to get back to this conversation with Daniel Atkinson, assistant director of KU's African Studies Center. He's sharing with us his recordings and his passion that both came from his visits to the Angola prison in Louisiana. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Daniel Atkinson, who is assistant director of the African Studies Center at KU. He's an ethnomusicologist. He visited the Angola prison, which is also known as the Louisiana State Penitentiary, and he has recorded music there, recorded prisoner testimonials, and he has a music project that has emerged from that, original music, but inspired by what you encountered there.
Yes, and you know, like most people who go through a traumatic experience, you come out of it, and in order to keep your humanity, you have to find a way to laugh at it or find a way to derive joy. That's what gospel is and blues is and hip-hop. And
so even going there was a traumatic experience, not even as a prisoner.
It was absolutely horrible. To see men of my father and grandfather's generation address me as sir was absolutely crushing. And to see a living, breathing, working plantation, knowing that tens of thousands of men have gone up that one-way road and have never left, and no one knows who they are. They're alone. And it's just, and to see the men who I know were going to end up in, it was just too much for me. And luckily, I was able to, my best friend in the world, Howard Wiley, came to visit me when I was in Seattle, and I had him trapped in the car. And I used to
good
talk,
tactic.
Yeah, I used to try to talk to him about it, and he would make jokes. And like, no, this is serious, man. You know, and then finally I had him trapped in the car. I was like, okay, now sit, listen, and shut up, you know, basically. And he sat and listened. We have to do something. Like, that's what I've been trying to tell you. So then we came up with the Angola Project, and it was a way for me to get it out of me because I was just holding on to too much. I got too close to the material. And Howard is a brilliant composer, saxophonist. And we recorded some arrangements of Harry Oster and Alan Lomax recordings. And we also did some arrangements of some of my recordings as well for the first recording, the Angola Project.
Yeah, I want to talk to you a little bit about the difference between the two albums. Mm-hmm. That for one of these albums, your collaborator, Howard, had not been to the prison yet.
No,
and then
just
for the second one, he had. How do you experience the difference in sound as it relates to the difference in experience level?
So we call it a jazz chamber recording. This is a multi-ethnic, multi-gender, multi-age ensemble we try to encompass the totality of the Afro-American musical experience. We go all the way back into field hollers and shouts and come all the way to hip-hop. And the first one was just me telling Howard about what I saw and heard and him listening to the recordings. And so we just went into the studio with a 13-member ensemble with violins, bass, trumpet, trombone, tenor saxophone, piano, three vocalists. And we just put it all together. Saxophonist David Murray's on the first recording. And the second time, in 2007, he came with me. And he was just on the tour with Lauryn Hill and then escaped for a few days to come down with me. And that was so much better to not have to go through that by myself. And he met most of the musicians, and he got to see it for himself. And we were lucky enough to get a grant through Intersection for the Arts in San Francisco and in a few other places. And he became the resin composer. I believe that's what the title was. And we wrote a suite called 12 Gates to the City, which is one of the pieces I recorded on the first trip. And that was all Howard just sitting and watching what was going on and taking it in and spitting it back out. There's a piece for John Taylor, Captain Donna DeMoss, who worked with us, and all kinds of other things go into it. There's even Robert Hillary King, who's one of the Angola Three, one of the people trapped in solitary confinement from 1972 to 2002. He's on the recording as well at the end.
Well, listening to these two albums, the first one to me, and I'm not a musician, but to me, the first one sounds like very straightforward jazz. And the second one, there is something so textured and so haunting about it. And I'd love to play a song from that album. It's called Old Highway 66. That was Old Highway 66 from the 12 Gates album by the Angola Project, which is Daniel Atkinson's collaboration with his best friend, jazz saxophonist Howard Wiley. Daniel, you've mentioned feeling somewhat traumatized by the experience of visiting Angola prison. How does it feel to you to hear this music?
First of all, this project with Howard is the best thing I've ever done. It's the thing that I'm the most proud of because there was really no help to do this. When you try to talk about this history in an honest way, you come up against lots of roadblocks or people who say it should be one way or another, because in America, we have grown insistent on being comfortable as we learn or engage with things that are naturally uncomfortable.
What do you mean by that?
We tend to want to revise history in a way that doesn't make things quite so bad, particularly for the dominant culture. Like, say, in Captain America, where Rogers is undressing in the induction center in 1941 or 1942 after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and is a black man undressing behind him. Having grandparents who fought in World War II and were Afro-American at the time, that was not the case. Everything was separate and unequal, that sort of a thing. And so we had no help, and so we had to do it on our own. So there's all kinds of elements in it that are us. But it's sometimes it's a little, you know, for better or worse, like it's sort of like Castaway with Tom Hanks. It's a really good movie and he's a really good actor, but in the end, it's a little too much Tom Hanks. So there's a little too much of us in there, but that's us. And then we have Faye Carroll, the beautiful singer, is on there. Marcus Shelby, the bass player who I've known since I was 18, is on there. It was like a real family sort of atmosphere, and we all entered into it, particularly with the second project, with a strong sense of purpose, because we knew that there were very few people doing this kind of work. Later on, when Marcellus had Plantation to the Penitentiary, and there's been a few other projects as well that are very similar, and it's well known on the underground circuit, but we have not been able to get distribution for it. It's hard for us to get gigs. Also, a 13-member ensemble is difficult to manage.
It's a lot of people to travel and a lot of, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we worked out a smaller version to where a select group can come, Faye Carroll, Howard, and a couple of others, and we can use rhythm section players in various areas who, the beautiful thing about it is that this is a manifestation of the Afro-American musical experience. So if you're a soulful musician, you can take right to this. And that was the point of it. It was supposed to be modular, but we weren't able to travel as such.
Daniel, this is I feel like these albums are a very unusual outcome for a PhD dissertation research project.
This wasn't part of my PhD, which is something that I felt I had to do, and I felt so much better afterward. Doing most of the project, the dissertation part by myself, I got too close to the material, and I'm just now coming out of the burnout, and that was 3 years ago. Next week, I will have finished the dissertation.
I want to ask you, what brought you to Kansas, speaking of having finished that 3 years ago?
I haven't been able to find opportunities to publish and to do what I do without suffering politically for it, particularly because of the way that my work exists in context of the Lomax tradition.
Suffering politically as in within, like, the academic system?
Academic system, the social system. I get lots of yeah buts and all kinds of reasons as to why that particular penitentiary should exist in the way that it does, but it's a direct descendant or beneficiary of the Hayes Compromise of 1877 and, of course, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution of 1865, which says that slavery is illegal except as punishment for a crime, which makes absolutely no sense unless you think of it from the perspective of people who do not want to clothe, feed, or house hundreds of thousands of people who are now quasi-citizens.
Wow. And so how did that bring you to Kansas, though?
Oh, well, it brought me to Kansas. That's what this is all about. It's difficult to find a position when you engage with history in such a way and you're honest about it, insisting on sovereignty for Afro-Americans. And so I have a very good friend who knows me from graduate school who works at KU, and he said, there's a position open here in KU. Why don't you come advertise for it? I was like, well, I've been to Morocco, but I don't know a whole lot about Africa. I know a little bit about the diaspora, but there's got to be people that are more qualified than I. I applied, and I got the position, and now every day is a learning experience as I immersed in Kansas and work to learn and study and promote the learning and study of all things African, which is a beautiful thing as well. I'm on an entirely different path now.
Yeah. What is next for you? What all of these stories you carry around several volumes of books in your head is the feeling I get talking to you. And now you have this new path that you've discovered in Kansas, from Kansas to Africa. What's next?
Ultimately, I would like to return to the Smithsonian and be a curator for the National Museum of African American History and Culture. I'm best suited in the classroom as well, or engaging with the public. That's where I'd like to be, particularly with children. That's where my heart is. That's where my passion is. I need to start writing again. I need to start playing again. I need to just become the creative being that I know I truly am and have not allowed myself to be because of the parameters of this project that I let get to me. But that's something I'm working toward, but every day is a step.
Every day is a step. Well, Daniel Atkinson, it's been so much fun talking to you. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's sadly all the time that we have for this incredible conversation with Daniel Atkinson, who is at KU as the Assistant Director of the African Studies Center. He's been sharing his research and his passion from his trips to the Angola prison. And now we're going to turn our attention to some other things. But again, Daniel, I just want to thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's beautiful. And if I can be of any help to anyone out there, that's what I'm here for.
We'll have to have you back again sometime.
I appreciate that.
An assurance I'm gonna keep on.